glad to have you with us today, and we're going to continue this our series on the Obama impact that Federal News Radio has been running all this week, and it's been very interesting. I've learned a lot. Emily Kopp of the Federal Drive is joining me this morning to give the show a little class, and our first guest is David Snell, and today's subject on Federal News Radio is the impact of the Obama administration on various government programs. One of the most important is retirement, and David is director of benefits services for the National Active and Retired Federal Employees Association. David, thank you for making the trek over here from Alexandria.
Well, you're very welcome, and I'm pleased to be here.
The theme of the column, and Emily, please chime in, because this is interesting stuff. The theme of the column today in our series is preparing for retirement. And some people say that you should start preparing for retirement on the second day on the job. And maybe a little bit early, but most people leave it till late. The problem in retiring from the government, particularly if you have a break in service, and particularly many women do, you have a break in service if you're a military veteran or if you've had service in a number of different agencies, is the paperwork trail you've accumulated. And there are breaks and whatnot. And people retire expecting to get a certain annuity. And in fact, they can get as little as 40% of that for an extended period of time until the interim annuity is recalculated and their final payment is made. And this has been a problem. It's nothing new to the Obama administration. This has been a problem forever, right?
Absolutely. I think the moral of the story is start 2 days after you get on the job planning for your retirement. Do not expect to get a full retirement a week or a month right after you retire. That calls for planning and looking at assets. Now, keeping in mind that for retirement financial security, you should receive in retirement about 70 to 80% of your pre-retirement income in order to continue to live in the manner that you have. It is very important for all federal employees to keep track of their records, and about 5 years before they really plan to retire, to start gathering those records and meeting with their retirement counselor and getting some advice and making sure that the holes that are in their retirement applications is going to be plugged. These days, it's very difficult with shared human resources offices and shared payroll offices for a lot of federal employees who are out all over the country. In fact, 80% of them are out outside of the D.C. area, to be able to meet with these human resource people to do that. So it's even more important to start early so that you can make arrangements, make your appointments, get your paperwork together.
It makes a lot of sense. I mean, when I was – before I took the position as Federal Drive co-host with Tom Temin, I was covering these workforce issues, and also know anecdotally that even people with a seemingly simple career path, say one division of one agency here in Washington, D.C., a lot of people retired in December. They're still waiting for their OPM benefits. And this is with the agency doing its part and even OPM's retirement services doing its part. So I think it just goes to show that you can't rely on anyone else to provide your information for you. While you have time, get your own papers in order. So make sure that you can step in, and you may not be able to speed up the process much, but if things sort of fall off of the wagon or there are unusual delays, you might be able to quickly remedy those or avoid those in the first place.
I've got a case in point here, but first, if you want to give us a call, if you have an anecdote, if you have a tale, if you have a question, good time to call 202-465-3080. That's 202-465-3080, and we'll be glad to take your call. Got an email this morning from Michael A., area code 630. Don't know where that is. long email. Bottom line, he said it took 15 months to finalize his annuity. So if you can imagine taking a 50% pay cut for 15 months. This is what happened to him. And he goes into great detail about it. But he had one of the things is he had a break in service. And I know before the show, talking with David Snell of NARF, and you were saying that when things go wrong, they really go badly wrong.
Yes. In my experience at OPM and from other tales of woe that I've heard, it seems like in some cases a problem that arises just won't go away with a particular individual's case. And one of the things that is most frustrating, of course, is communication with the Office of Personnel Management and what they are waiting on or what seems to be the problem. I know that Director Berry and his strategy has outlined communications as one of the pillars or the lanes that he wants to improve on, and it still needs a lot of work. I don't know if it's ever going to get to a point where it's perfect, but again, going back to what I said earlier, getting ready for retirement is not something that should be taken lightly. And even then, I mean, you can do everything right and still lose the ball game. Something may happen with paperwork, with something that's outside of the control of both you or OPM when we're dealing with a lot of records. Things get lost. So start early, plan ahead, know what you need. Now, one of the newest changes in retirement that have come out this week, OPM has revised the application form for those under the Federal Employees Retirement System. They wanted that to be implemented effective September 30th, but then realizing that a lot of folks have already turned in their applications under the old application or the current one, they changed that to December 30th. So after December 30th, there'll be a whole different look on the application for federal employees when they retire. So, you know, there are being changes made, and it's imperative that both the employee and their agency HR people keep up with that.
And just to add to that, I think we do need to give the Office of Personnel Management credit. I know it's tried in the past different ways to kind of remedy this retirement backlog with mixed success, but it does seem like the approach it's taking now, while not alleviating the problem entirely, is certainly a move in the right direction. And the stars are in line in that there's more growing awareness. We've seen on Capitol Hill, lawmakers really getting pretty tough with OPM. Virginia Senator Mark Warner introduced not too long ago a customer service bill that was very similar to one that was in the House, but actually included a special measure specifically targeting OPM's retirement services. And when I spoke with his staff back then, they were telling me that they were making these sort of crank calls, if you were, or impromptu calls to the retirement services a facility up there in Pennsylvania just to see what would happen and to really test the customer service. So there is a lot of pressure from lawmakers, and that can do a lot of good to get the agency moving as fast as it can down the right path.
Right, and I think the secret weapon, too, here is John Berry himself, because he worked on Capitol Hill for Steny Hoyer, so he's got a lot of juice and a wide experience, and I want to talk about that in a second. We need to take a short break here. Federal News Radio will be right back. Welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey. I'm joined today by Emily Kopp from the Federal Drive, and she's in here to add color, charm, beauty, poise, and with David Snell from the National Active and Retired Federal Employees. And we're talking about our series this week on Federal News Radio about how is President Obama doing? What's his impact been on the federal establishment there? Came in with certain promises and hopes, and how's he doing? As Mayor Ed Koch used to ask people in New York. I was talking about John Berry before we had a commercial break. The one reason I think this initiative is working as well as it is the fact that A. Berry is a Fed. He worked on the Hill for Steny Hoyer for many years on federal employee matters. He was at the Interior Department. Later on, he was at Treasury, and he was had the best job in town, director of the National Zoo. If we could use our clout with him to get in to see the panda early, maybe. But he's dedicated to the federal establishment. And early in the administration, President Obama took him to two different cabinet meetings, introduced him to the secretaries, and said, "This guy calls. Take his call." And I think that gave him tremendous clout. And so now when they've got this initiative to speed up the retirement process and eliminate the backlog, when somebody from OPM contacts their counterpart at Interior, Justice, GSA, whatever, they'll listen to them.
I think that's a big deal because I've heard the complaint joke among OPM staff is that they're really not sort of the Office of Personnel Management, but the Office of Personnel Recommendations. And they, you know, have this a lot of carrots, but not a lot of sticks to get agencies to sort of fall in line and standardize how they do HR across government. So I think you're right that having a good leader in place and someone who is respected on Capitol Hill, even by the other party, can go a long way towards at least giving people a little bit more faith in the agency where it's had this long legacy, particularly with retirement, of not getting this particular problem right.
Yes, and I hope that clout still holds. One of the pillars, going back to the OPM strategic plan, one of the pillars was partnering with agencies, which is very important when we're talking about retirement and the flow of records and the accuracy of those records. During the hearings this past winter that we had regarding retirement processing, NARF, President Joe Boden, asked Senator Warner and OPM if there wasn't something that OPM could have in the way of teeth to put some pressure on agencies to make sure that their retirement submissions were completed and that they were on time. We really wanted OPM to get some muscle on this and be able to move the agencies instead of recommending, as Emily just said, but to move and force the agencies to do a better job on their end. So I hope in partnering with the agencies that Director Berry has been able to find something that he can use to toward that end. OPM has also recently come out with a new agency checklist. It's a rather large document for agencies to use. It's much more detailed but if the agencies use that checklist, I think it will go a long way to making sure that the retirement applications that are being submitted are complete and ready for OPM to do the calculation and issued the annuity.
I want to say one thing on that. First of all, I do think that we should give OPM credit as well for sort of acknowledging its problem with the retirement backlog and also sort of making its progress transparent. Every month, about the fifth of the month, it posts a new chart on its website that has the retirement backlog, the new claims it's received that month, how many it's processed. And you can actually track month by month since it started this new strategy back in January, that in fact it has made progress consistently. But David, I wanted to ask you, I mean, just anecdotally, are your members feeling the impact of this new strategy that OPM has started since January? I mean, are you getting fewer complaints at all, fewer people requesting help? Anecdotally, what are you hearing about it?
Well, we're still getting complaints from people who have been in the system too long. I mean, I have one yesterday where a disability annuitant retired in 2009 and still hasn't had these are those rather rare exceptions. And I do hear glimmers of hope when I hear, well, I did get in and I actually talked to somebody at OPM or somebody did respond to my email and that sort of thing. Another facet of the communications piece that has come about recently is individual new retirees can actually track the progress of their case by going to OPM's website and the services online, and by using their claim number and their personal identification number that's provided by OPM, they can actually see where and what stage their retirement case is at. While that's no help if it if they don't get, you know, their annuity completed in 90 days, it still is a step in the right direction and provides some kind of information that retirees are looking for.
Well, I understand that OPM has taken a number of its employees and has also arranged for agencies to take their employees who are in this process and take them up to Boyers, Pennsylvania, and take them in that coal mine and look at the system and how it's rows and rows and rows of cabinets with papers. But it's vital to see that, because in this day of NCIS and Criminal Minds, you know, you go to the computer and in 5 minutes they've checked the DNA, solved the case, and captured Bin Laden. It doesn't work that way. This is a paperwork trail.
Absolutely, and actually, it doesn't work that way in crime either.
Exactly.
Just for educational purposes, what Mike's referring to in Boyers, Pennsylvania, is OPM's retirement operations center. This is the place where all the retirement applications from all the agencies first go into OPM. At that point, OPM puts them into an interim pay status if they're able to, and assembles the documents, and some of the retirements are actually adjudicated up there, but many of them are adjudicated down in Washington, D.C. Now, it's not a coal mine. It's a limestone mine, but it is absolutely huge, the people that work in that mine, along with many other companies that have offices there for safekeeping of records. I don't think an atomic bomb would be able to destroy the records that are there. But the people that work, the federal employees, if you can imagine working in a limestone cave or mine, the working conditions are absolutely incredible. Once you're in there, you think you're in a high-rise office building without windows, but they've made everything as far as working conditions almost as good as you would find in Washington, D.C. at an agency headquarters. But yeah, the Retirement Operations Center in Boyers, Pennsylvania, they're the depot for the retirement records. They're also where most of the mail from individuals to OPM go, where they're associated with case files and then sent to Washington for response. They also do an awful lot of other functions that are not retirement adjudication. OPM is also responsible for doing things like refunding retirement contributions for people that leave. Of course, the survivor benefits when a retiree or an employee dies are also done by the Office of Personnel Management. You've got military retired pay applications where somebody's paying for the military service so they can get credit for civil service. There's a whole bunch of functions that are done in that retirement operations center, and it's all underground.
Yeah, I mean, that part of it actually is a bit fascinating to me, that these people are working deep underground. If you imagine, probably no windows, because where would they lead out to? And up there in Pennsylvania, not down here where OPM has its headquarters. And I know one of the problems that's had throughout the years is a workforce shortage. It's people who know this old-fashioned system well have been retiring. So what OPM did this year is that they hired back a lot of those retirees because this is not necessarily the type of work that a young person wants to get into. I mean, you don't really want to be working underground in Boyers, Pennsylvania with all this paperwork. That's not the world that a lot of, you know, college graduates are looking to join.
Exactly right. And also, too, it is a skill. It's not just something, degree notwithstanding, you need to go through this and do it. David and I were talking before the show about this. One of the problems, and this happened years ago, to shows how far back this problem goes, is that one of the military departments, and I don't remember which one, so I don't want to defame them, but one of the military departments had a habit of saving up all their retirement applications and then sending them over on the 31st or the 1st. And that meant you might have 5,000 mm-hmm. people, and you save them all up. So you retire, turning your papers on the 31st, thinking you're going to get your check shortly. But it doesn't even go to OPM, not even sent out, until the 30th or the 31st of the following month. Is that still a problem, David?
I don't think it's as much a problem. I think in the intervening years that OPM has been able to ride the herd on agencies to make sure that they submit these applications, and now they're doing it electronically as well as paper. But, you know, that kind of a situation where everything comes in at once, it doesn't help in getting retirement applications adjudicated. Now, the backlog that OPM is experiencing now really had its origins back in 2009. If you look at the statistical reports from OPM, the new on-rolls that were added in 2009 for most categories of retirements are pretty even from what they have been, except for early retirements. Early retirements that had been 4,000 or 5,000 a year jumped to over 12,000, and the reason for that was the U.S. Postal Service in that year had an early out and allowed a whole bunch of folks to retire all at once, and that kind of
that clogged the pipeline.
Absolutely,
didn't it?
Clogged the pipeline. And OPM is just still recovering from that.
Okay. Going to take a short break here. Our number is 202-465-3080, 465-3080. We'll be right back here on the Federal Drive. Welcome back to Your Turn. I am Mike Clausey. I'm here with Emily Kopp today from the Federal Drive. We borrowed her for this show. With us is midway in our series on Federal News Radio about the Obama impact, what the impact of the Obama administration has been on various federal programs, that the people side of government, the care and feeding of government employees and retirees and taking care of them. And we're emphasizing retirement today. Our number here is 202-465-3080, and we've got Morris from Denver on the line. Morris, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Hey, thanks for calling. What's your question?
I'm trying to find out about how long I'm going to have to wait. I am a retired civil servant, and I had a quadro on my annuity from a divorce, a qualified domestic relation order, and my former wife passed away 9 February. And since then, I've been providing all the paperwork that they needed to restore my annuity back to its full value. And the last I can get back out of them is that it's sitting in some legal office or something.
Well, I'm sure glad that we have David Snell here, because Emily and I are a little staring into space on this one. David, what do you think?
Well, okay. Court orders in general... you remember the process, Mr. Morris, is it?
Yes.
You know, they before you get your annuity, the court order has to be processed to figure out how much is going to be split and how each party is going to be paid. Well, in a case where this divorce decree apparently is no longer in effect because one of the parties, the former spouse, is deceased, you would think it would be pretty easy, but again, we're dealing with workloads, and everybody's supposedly, you know, first in, first out type thing, and they've got a backlog in all of their workloads, including court orders, although I was told by OPM not too long ago that they're making some headway on it. In your case, they're going to have to pull that divorce decree, make sure that there isn't anything in the language of the divorce decree that would possibly keep that that payment that was going to your ex-spouse going to an estate or a child or something like that. So they're going to do that first, and then if it looks okay, they will go ahead and make the change. But you know, don't I don't know what to tell you as far as time. I don't know exactly.
David, is there any way he could call you or email you?
Well, certainly he can. He can certainly email me at excuse me, dsnell@narf.org, and I'll be glad to look into it.
Yeah, that's a complication I hadn't thought of. I mean, it is,
but I think it's worth repeating what David was just saying a few minutes ago, that now OPM does have a function where you can, and David, please, you know the details, but where you can actually check the status of your own application, your own claim, through the website, and so kind of keep up with that, and perhaps know what part of the OPM Retirement Division you might need to petition.
Okay, we're going to take a short break here, and then when we come back, we'll be talking with Steve Watkins and Sean Riley from the Federal Times. Thank you, David Snell from NARF, for being here. And stick around, because we're going to continue talking about the Obama impact, and particularly on retirement and services like that. We'll be right back here on Federal News Radio. Welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey, glad to have you with us. We were just talking with David Snell from the National Active and Retired Federal Employees, and he's going to stick around along with Emily Kopp, who's hanging over from her Federal Drive show this morning. On the line now, we have Steve Watkins, editor of the Federal Times, and Sean Riley, senior writer for the Times. Gentlemen, are you with us?
Yeah, good to be with you. Hey,
thank you. Thank you for doing it. We're in midweek here at Federal News Radio with our Obama impact, and today's emphasis is on retirement and other benefits. But I wanted to ask you, we keep reading about devastating cuts coming up when and if sequestration hits us January 2nd or 3rd. How devastating are these overstated?
I think unquestionably they'd be very significant. The administration, pursuant to a law that Congress enacted, that was enacted back in August, last week released a report, really just saying what the impact would be in terms of percentage cut on agency funding, agency and program funding in FY13. And these cuts would begin taking effect January 2nd, so about one quarter of the way through FY13. Based on current funding levels, which could be a little different from what agencies actually experienced at that time, the average domestic discretionary program would be cut, or agency would be cut 8.2%. Defense programs, security spending would be cut 9.4%. And again, this would be a cut that would have to be absorbed one quarter of the way through the fiscal year, so the impact would be magnified beyond what it already would be.
How much leeway would agencies have to, I mean, they say, okay, we're going to take a 9.2% cut, but we want to take it in certain areas. I know defense is not involved in this, but I know one time the military was saying that they don't want to blunt the spear, take it out of the support, but not the sharp end of the stick. How much freedom, if any, do agencies have?
The expectation is they would have a significant amount of discretion. And I should note that military personnel will be exempt from sequestration, and also, according to the Obama administration, all of the Veterans Affairs Department will be exempt. But for agencies that will be experiencing it, the folks I've talked to have said they do expect to have some discretion. But the real key to this is going to be the Office of Management and Budget, which will be is expected to at some point issue detailed guidance on exactly how to apply sequestration. So far, however, all that OMB has put out is a two-page memo in late July, essentially telling agencies, you know, we'll be talking to you about this, and, you know, asking them basically to start thinking about how they go about it.
The Postal Service, second largest federal agency, I guess, getting smaller by the minute with downsizing in their plans. But as David Snell was saying, the big backlog in retirement claims that OPM experienced in 2009 came largely from the Postal Service. It is one of the largest agencies. It offered early outs, and it continues to offer them. What's going on over at the Postal Service?
Well, it's pretty much a continuation of what we've already seen. They are desperately trying to shrink their workforce, and they did offer buyouts to both postmasters and to mail handlers. With the postmasters, I mean, with the impact was essentially to reduce the ranks of postmasters by about one-fifth, or about 20%, which is probably unprecedented. But with mail handlers, you just had a few thousand taking advantage of the $15,000 buyout. And I think the Postal Service probably would have wanted to see a lot more of those folks opt to either resign or retire because, as you know, they're in the Postal Service is in the process of shrinking its mail processing plant network. And if all goes according to plan, and Postal Service emphasized those plans can change, you know, by the end of 2014, you're going to have about half the number of processing plants that you do now. And so clearly you need a lot fewer people to work in them.
I think the Postal Service's predicament is an interesting one because its financial problems and its desire to shrink its workforce are well known. And it has thousands of employees that are, in fact, retirement eligible could decide to retire any day. But because they know that, in fact, they might be eligible for one of these sort of sweetheart deals to leave, I think a lot of people who might otherwise go have decided to hang on and see what they can get. And then the problem is that the buyouts that the Postal Service is able to offer, they just aren't actually that good. I mean, they're at $25,000 or less, and that doesn't get you very far when you think about stopping work, full stop.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I know, for example, there are a lot of clerks, at least I've heard from a lot of postal clerks, who are eagerly awaiting some sort of buyout offer from the Postal Service to members of the American Postal Workers Union. That issue has gotten entangled in some questions about whether the Postal Service is living up to its most recent contract with the APWU. And certainly there are some members of the union that are quite frustrated because they would like to leave, but they don't want to leave if there's the possibility of a buyout on the horizon. And the other issue is that in many cases you're going to have people, postal workers serve in areas that don't have a lot going on economically. I wrote a few months ago about a postmaster from southwestern Ohio, a very economically depressed area. He's got two teenage children. And if he retired, he told me that his annuity would barely cover his house payment. And there are just no other jobs out there that can offer what he's making as a postmaster, so he decided to hang on.
And another component on Emily's point is, you know, the buyout, of course, is the carrot to incentivize a lot of employees to leave. But there is a stick in some of these cases, which is the threat of a possible RIF. And the Postal Service has brought that up with the postmasters. So, you know, a lot of postmasters are, I'm sure, factoring that into their calculation. As the Postal Service is closing offices, reducing hours, they need less people. So there's definitely a not-so-subtle threat out there that employees can be riffed if they don't take the buyouts.
And Federal Times, guys, I know you have people up there on Capitol Hill all the time. The Postal Service has said that it's got to have some sort of new law to help it out. What is the latest that you're hearing from Capitol Hill?
The latest is a sense that that everything's on hold until the update elections. And, you know, as urgently as the Postal Service would love to get some financial relief, particularly from Congress, it's just not going to happen within, at least not for a few more months.
Hey, I want to switch gears for a second here and ask you about the situation Secretary Kathleen Sebelius is in at Health and Human Services. She's been found, according to the Office of Special Counsel, to be in violation of the Hatch Act. What did she do? What did she allegedly do, and what's the likely penalty?
Well, Steve Losey reported on that, and basically she was at an event. I'm trying to remember. I think it was in Atlanta, but another city, and she was there acting on behalf or as the Health and Human Services Secretary. However, and I believe it was a I forgot, again, lesbian group.
It was the Human Rights Campaign.
The Human Rights Campaign. And she was speaking to them, and during her remarks, she basically said something to the effect of, hey, we need to get behind Obama and extend him for another term, which is a big no-no, mixing campaigning with official duty. So afterward, she realized there was a problem and so recategorized the trip as a campaign event, basically. It was reimbursed by the Democratic National Committee. And but nevertheless, there was a Hatch Act complaint filed against her. The Office of Special Counsel said, yes, indeed, she mixed campaigning with and mixed politics with her job and violated the Hatch Act. And essentially forwarded that to the White House, and urged the White House to take some action. Now, interestingly, the Office of Special Counsel did not recommend any specific action be taken, so that gives the White House a lot of leeway in terms of how to treat it. So far, we've not really heard any sign or indication whatsoever that the White House plans to do anything. In fact, there's been, if anything, all the writing on the wall suggests they're just going to keep quiet and not do a thing.
Steve Watkins, let me put you on hold here. We need to take a short break, and we'll be right back here on Federal News Radio. Welcome back to Your Turn, Mike Causey. And Emily Kopp, my co-host today, has a question for you.
Yeah, we were talking just before we went to the break about Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius and sort of the pickle that she's in because the Office of Special Counsel is telling President Barack Obama that she violated the Hatch Act, yet did not recommend any certain action to the president. So my question for you, the Federal Times guys, is how rare is it that the special counsel does not recommend specific action? Because I've been told by the special counsel in the past that they really feel like one reason they're pushing for a new Hatch Act law is that their hands are tied. And if somebody violates the Hatch Act, there are very few different types of penalties that can happen. I mean, you know, termination is one.
That's correct. That's a good question. I haven't really looked at all of the Hatch Act violation reports that they've done over the years and seen how many of those come with specific proposed remedies, what have you. I believe in the case of, for instance, Loretta Doane, the former GSA administrator, they did recommend that she be fired or admonished. They outlined some specific steps. So in this case, that they didn't do that. It could have been because HHS or Sebelius quickly tried to correct the problem by recategorizing the event and getting reimbursement for it, but. And the White House has basically said, you know, as much that, well, she recognized very quickly this was a problem and got reimbursement, so we don't see it as a problem. But you're right. I mean, the Hatch Act is a real source of concern now for the Office of Special Counsel because so much is going on with the advent of social media and emails and so forth. So I think they are really grappling with how to handle a lot of kind of new scenarios that they weren't dealing with even 4 or 5 years ago. You know, for instance, if Conan and O'Brien, there's a video clip of Conan telling a joke on Obama or Romney and someone forwards it to a colleague. Does that represent a violation of the Hatch Act? You know, so there's a lot of things like that that I think are kind of in the gray area that need to be sorted out. And as a result, they also need some more flexible responses to some of those scenarios.
Well, Loretta Doane was recommended that she be fired. The White House asked for her resignation, and she did resign, even with kind words about President Bush. But the thing I recall is how political it became, because the Democrats were in control of Congress at the time, and Henry Waxman's committee led the charge to punish her. And Tom Davis came to her defense. And the irony of it is the special counsel himself got into trouble later on and was ordered jailed for a month. I don't know if that was ever carried out, but these things can get nasty.
Oh, no question. Yeah. I mean, there were, in that situation, there were, you know, just politics all over the place. And as you mentioned, Scott Block himself was kind of embroiled in his own controversy with the White House, and Karl Rove figured into all of it. So, I think that was a unique case.
Well, very good. Well, thank you very much. And again, thanks. Any final thoughts, parting shots?
Well, we are waiting to see the CR. That's expected to get passed by the Senate this week, of course, extending the pay raise another 6 months. And so the big question is going to be whether unions are going to be successful at pressing Congress to enact retroactive pay raises once a budget is approved.
Very good. Thank you, gentlemen. Thanks so much. Emily, thank you for being here today. David Snell, we'll see you all next week. Remember, the show's archived. And check out our series on Federal News Radio about the Obama impact. We'll see you next Wednesday.